This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The city and county of Honolulu is currently in Tier 3 of our state's reopening strategy. Pandemic restrictions across several industries on Oahu have been loosened. But what does this mean for local businesses and nonprofits? The Conversation's Russell Subiono spoke with the head of two local fitness facilities to gauge the impact.
That's a group exercise class at the YMCA of Honolulu, an activity that went silent after the COVID-19 pandemic made it to our state a year ago. Earlier this month, the city and county of Honolulu moved from Tier 2 into Tier 3 of the state's reopening strategy. The move impacted a handful of local industries, one of which were gyms. They were allowed to increase capacity from 25% to 50%, and double the attendance of indoor fitness classes from 5 to 10. The YMCA of Honolulu has 8 branches across Oahu, the most of any fitness facility chain. Their president and CEO, Greg Weibel, explained Tier 3's significance.
So we will be able to obviously serve our members easier, allowing additional access to our health and wellness facilities and programs. That increase from 25% to 50% adds that additional opportunities. Our group exercise classes, which is some of the favorite parts of what people come to the Y for, has also a significant change, which will allow up to 10 people in indoor and outdoor classes. And we're known for the wide variety of classes that we provide, as well as in the pool classes, and it's for all ages, abilities, interests, and we have over 80 of those classes per week. So that will be significant for us. The other thing that we're doing that will be a change is we used to require a reservation to access the YMCA, just to make sure that we had significant capacity. We're waiving those reservations that are needed, and so now people will be able to come on their own time. But to do that, we're adding another procedure, a check-in and check-out, so we actually can monitor exactly how many people are inside our facility at all times, and if we're at our capacity, then we'll ask people to wait outside. We're going to keep doing a reservation system for our group exercise classes and pools, just to allow members to, with that certainty of knowing that they're going to have a space and a place in those particular programs, which are, you know, more limited in size.
While all businesses were impacted by 2020's economic shutdown due to the pandemic, small businesses were especially hit hard. Even as Hawaii's businesses started reopening at the end of last year and the island began moving up the tiers of the state's reopening strategy, many gyms were forced to adapt to new rules, the biggest of which was the mask mandate. Bryant Powers owns CrossFit Oahu. He detailed how his business and members adapted.
That's how it is at our spot. You have the mask not only on, but over your nose. And if you need to take it off, you go outside. I think, obviously, it'd be better and easier not to work out with a mask on. But if the choice is to work out and enjoy what you've been doing, and you just have to have the mask on, it's really after, like, I would say 2 weeks, not that big a deal. In terms of the annoyingness of it, you're always going to be slower paced, and it, you know, it's going to be a little bit harder in that regard. And then obviously we could go into details of what masks are probably a little bit better to not feel like they're getting sucked into your mouth or getting completely drenched and stuff like that. And the crazy thing too about the mask is we're starting to get more drop-in visitors. I mean, historically at Honolulu, we have probably between 80 and 100 drop-ins a month for people that want to do CrossFit from like Waikiki or traveling military. And they've all been really good with the mask too, even if they came from like Texas or something where, you know, you don't have to wear the mask. Everybody kind of respected that and has been really good with it.
YMCA of Honolulu's members also adapted to working out in masks. Greg Weibel shared some tips.
They haven't been in and been using a mask while exercising. So you can use a surgical mask, which allows a little bit easier to breathe. And then we also are recommending there's this kind of face covering that goes underneath your mask, which allows just a little bit more airflow. And so we've been showing people how to do that and allows for that additional easier breathing while you're working out. At first it might seem a little bit difficult or challenging or just different to work out using a mask, but our members get used to it. I've gotten used to that as well. And that's just our current reality.
As our state moves forward through the pandemic and we look toward reaching the next tier of the state's reopening strategy, CrossFit Oahu's Bryant Powers shared what he was looking forward to most.
Oh, man. So March 18th is when we shut down. We shut down a few days early, I think, before the official thing. We had set, talking about community events, we had set up, I made a giant 4x8 sheet, and it was a 2-scale drawing of paddling on the rower, the meters from Niihau, obviously wouldn't do it this way in real life, but going from Niihau to Kauai, and then all the way across the different channels of the Hawaiian Isles. So we added up the meters that you would have to row, and we got groups of 2 or 4 people to make teams, and you could check off the boxes on this giant chart on the wall. Because after class, you could stay and row some more meters, so you could go basically row across all of the channels of the Hawaiian Isles, so you're ending at the Big Island. And we only had that up for like 2 days before we had to shut down. So I'm excited to bring that back, because that's a fun thing to do after class, is just to kind of see, like you're talking about, like work with your partner and also see like where other people stayed and did 5,000 meters after class or something. So I'm excited to get that back.
As the head of the island's largest group of fitness facilities, Weibel also talked about his hope for the YMCA of Honolulu and its members.
You know, we are a social service nonprofit organization, and we continue to evolve based on what community asks us to do. The pandemic was no different. So while we had been doing some things historically, the pandemic brought us new ways to think about serving the community and new needs in the community. And so as we roll forward and think about what is it that the community needs from us, so beyond the health and wellness, we're going to continue to do both virtual, in-person. We've actually started reaching out and calling our kapuna, really thinking differently about how we reach people and what access looks like, as well as we're providing lots of opportunities for kids, of course. So if we think about the learning challenges that they've experienced over the past year, we know that our kids have fallen behind academically. And the Y is a place where we serve kids their social and emotional well-being, as well as we add an educational component to our service delivery. So we know that that's what our community is going to need from us. Right now, we're going to double down on our kids and their future to make sure that they get to a better place and a different side of this pandemic. And we are also really focused on our kapuna. We know that they have had lots of isolation, lots of stress. They've taken it, had to take on a hard part of this pandemic. And we know that the Y is a safe place for them, as well as their community. Many of them consider it their second home. And so we're going to figure out how to do that, again, in person, as well as virtually or on the phone.
That was Greg Weibel of the YMCA of Honolulu and Bryant Powers of CrossFit Oahu. They were talking Tier 3 impacts with the conversation's Russell Subiono.
The knee joint is one of the most commonly injured areas of the body. What should you do if you have a meniscal tear? I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Join me today on The Body Show. We'll talk to an orthopedic expert about the latest recommendations on how to treat this common knee condition. That's today at 6:30 on The Body Show.
Support for HPR comes from Diamond Head Theater. In Shout, the mod musical, five English girls coming of age in the 60s and 70s sing classics such as To Sir With Love and Downtown. Opens this Friday. Tickets at DiamondHeadTheater.com.
First, there's nothing new for Iolani School. The school believes it was the first to switch to online learning during the pandemic, and it was the first to deal with a positive COVID case on campus when it did start to come back. That experience has forced a rigor that now is to include COVID testing on site. And it's trying something else new. It's expanding its summer boarding program to the general public. The camp is normally offered to international or mainland students. We talked to the head of school, Tim Cottrell, about the changes to its program.
You know, we've had nearly the full school year on campus, really safely, no on-campus COVID transmission, and we've had our boarding program in session for that whole time as well. So we've got a good amount of time under our belt in terms of running these kinds of programs on campus, but there's still a lot of complications with young people traveling, right, both sometimes in terms of visas these days or travel restrictions. So as we thought about it for this year, what we thought was, why don't we open it up and bring more of a focus for in-state students, knowing that the school year has been kind of up and down for a lot of young people, right? You know, they may be looking at next school year and thinking, their parents may be thinking, am I, you know, at grade level looking to move into the next year? Has my child lost a lot of social opportunities, places for social and emotional growth that they would have normally experienced? Things that we might normally look at during the summer, different camp experiences and things like that, are not as available as they used to be. So taking that all together, we took a look and thought, you know, it might be interesting to put together a program where we focus on in-state kids and try to address those needs coming out of this school year.
Yeah, I mean, we don't hear usually a lot about, you know, extensive overnight camps, summer camps. You know, that's a big thing, I know, on the East Coast. And I know they've had their challenges, you know, with COVID. But the places that have offered it seem to have managed from what I've seen.
Yeah, it's manageable. Of course, you have a lot of safety protocols. You know, so with our boarding program, we've managed it because the students are kind of broken up in little family clusters. When they're outside of that cohort, they're wearing full PPE, right? And so there's a lot of management that goes into it in terms of the residential life side. But I think, like other boarding programs, you know, we've been able to do that successfully, and so we want to apply that to the summer.
You know, I know as I was sitting at a stoplight this morning on my way to work, I saw a couple of kids walking over to Iolani, and they had their masks on and their visors in hand, because you have visors for all the kids.
Yeah. You know, back when this all started and everybody went online, some of the folks in our Sullivan Center for Innovation and Leadership started making face shields. Right, and it's sort of over the progression of months, making them and donating them to the community, we got better and better and better at it. And there was actually a version we made that was used in surgical theaters. Right, it was far enough away from the face so that you could wear surgical loops. And when we were considering coming back on campus, one of the big stumbling blocks is, how do you bring kids together and have them eat? Right, because that's a time when, of course, the face mask is going to be off, and it's a lot of people on campus. And that's where the idea of, oh, well, we'll have them wear these face shields. So at that point, I think we donated about 17,000 to the community. So we were in full production. We were able to make all these face shields for our community, a number of multiples over. We donated them to some other partner schools that we worked with as well. We make them all the way down to little teeny versions for five-year-olds, you know, so for our kindergartners, all the way up to adult versions. So it's worked really well, you know, and so on our campus, any students in any interior space are always wearing the two things, both a face mask and a face shield.
Right, so that's going to be standard during the summer session.
That's correct. When they're outside, they can pull their face mask down, right, and just wear their face shield. So it kind of gives them a break, right, from wearing the face mask all day long. And we installed more than 10 kind of large circus scope kind of tents on our campus. So we also made this move where our students are outside much more than they normally would be during the school year.
For classes?
Yes, for
under
classes
the tents?
And for all their frees, any study hall, any free, they would be outside. For lunch, they're outside. So we wanted to take advantage of kind of the safety, the increased safety in terms of transmission of being outside.
So what age will you be looking for as far as the summer camp?
For summer camp, it's sixth graders, rising sixth graders to rising 10th graders, which is roughly maybe 11 to 16 years old.
Usually during the summer, Iolani offers a number of SAT, ACT prep classes. And, you know, many colleges, they've dropped that requirement. But, I mean, would the students at that camp be able to take things like that?
Absolutely. So the tuition for the summer program covers classes, sports, activities, events, meals, accommodations, excursions. So, again, it's this kind of pseudo EduCamp, right, where they'll be able to select from our summer course catalog and take what they want to take. But then once the day rolls on, it moves much more into a kind of camp experience for the kids.
And talk about how you'll be adding, I guess, testing on campus.
Yeah, so we just got through this. We got our CLIA waiver that allows us to do testing on our campus. And yesterday, we received three pallets that had 20,000 of the Abbott Lab antigen tests. That'll enable us to integrate that into operations, right? So yeah, that'll be used in the summer program. But for us now on campus, I think this weekend we're having our first kind of scrimmages with some other schools, and we're able to do that because we can use a testing protocol, right? Every student who's participating will get tested prior, right, and tested after, so that we can, you know, keep much closer track of any possible transmission that would happen.
So do you know, are you like the first private school to offer this on-site testing?
We're not. Kamehameha was out ahead of everybody on this, and they do it scientifically to a more rigorous degree than we do. So we're using the Abbott antigen test. Kamehameha has been implementing the actual PCR test.
It sounds like things are lining up. You're adding the testing component.
Yeah.
You know, you've been able to manage thus far with the kids on campus. They're distancing. They're wearing the extra protective gear.
Yeah. And, you know, the other part is, you know, some of it is it's not always all that complicated. The basis of our safety protocol is really the PPE. You know, don't let breaths get into the air and don't breathe in somebody else's breath. And then our students wash or sanitize their hands every time they go in or out any room. Right. So there's a lot of hand sanitation that goes on. And then the other things are on top of that, the social distancing, cohorting, all of those other strategies as well. But it has worked well. You know, it's teenagers and young people, children are amazing in terms of their willingness to do these things. You know, I think the trade-off is just if I can get back into the social milieu that is so important to me, it's fine. I'll wear a mask. I'll wear a face shield. I'll do all of those things if I can be around my friends. So they've shown us that they're very motivated to stick to the guidelines that we've trained them on.
Do you think you're going to attract more of the private school students or public school? Well, you know, because I know cost is an issue for a lot of folks.
Yeah, it's you know, it's in the ballpark of the kinds of summer experiences kids would go to, right? Any for anywhere from 2 weeks to 6 weeks. I don't know. You know, there is very limited capacity. We can only support 112 students in our dorm. You know, we also know that even though it's not focused on students from the mainland or internationally, there are students from those locations that are signing up for the summer. We hope to get, you know, a nice cross-section of kids from all the different, you know, kind of demographics, location, and different schools. I think there is, in many different instances, the common theme of kind of an up-and-down year, right? And wanting to make sure when a student gets ready and goes back to school, they're on grade level, and some of the social deficits that have happened this year for kids would be addressed.
When will the camp run, and when do people have to sign up by?
We'll be opening up sign-ups. I think we're just moving out of the period of where our faculty and staff sign up for a summer program, so it's going to be open soon. It runs from June 13th all the way through July 31st. for different kinds of sessions. The full six-week session is June 13th to July 24th. The sessions run anywhere from $2,500 to $11,000.
Anything else you think we need to know?
If I can have a few more seconds, there's another fun thing that we're about to launch as well, along the same theme of an up-and-down year for so many students. This summer, for the first time, and probably the only time, we're going to offer all of our newly enrolled students coming in at kindergarten 6, 7, 8, and 9 free summer preparation courses. So whereas, you know, we always have a course catalog of summer prep programs, you know, essentially getting ready for ninth grade in English or getting ready for ninth grade in math. But what our board has decided is that this year we will make those available for free to our newly enrolled students to make sure that as they're looking at coming into Iolani, they'll, you know, be on really good footing when they enter the school year.
That was a conversation we had last week with Tim Cottrell, head of school for Iolani. For links to the summer camp program, head to our website.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Par Hawaii, an energy company whose more than 680 employees are committed to a culture of safety and customer service. Learn more at parhawaii.com.
Honolulu Civil Beats Reality Check today takes us out to the garden, community gardens, that is. Reporter Claire Caulfield joins us today. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
So you are focusing on the west side and the lack of community gardens out there.
Yes, there is certainly a growing call across the island for more community gardens, but this article really focused on the west side because we heard so many people living out on the west side about, you know, why their asks for community gardens have been turned down over the years.
Now, I recall when Mayor Frank Fossey started this concept of community gardens, and it was really mainly in town, I think, for a lot of the, you know, apartment dwellers, right? So they have a little plot of land that they could play around in.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I looked back through the archives to understand why these gardens were first opened. And while there were definitely mentions of like, oh, the physical health benefits, oh, it reduced my grocery bill, the main focus of this program was offering a fun recreational activity for those apartment dwellers you mentioned, because other people, you know, had yards, they could garden. Apartment dwellers didn't. So it really made sense that in the 70s, these gardens were opened in Honolulu. Urban core. And you even see that when the garden was open in Kaneohe in 1977, it specifically mentioned that they opened it in that area for residents of a newly constructed apartment building. Mm-hmm. But over the decades, the rest of the island has urbanized and gardens haven't followed. So that was one part of kind of the tension in this piece.
And so I think folks may know these community gardens because some of them are in city parks, but there are other gardens that really aren't part of this system.
Yes, so there are other opportunities to grow community or to grow your own food across the island. But part of the reason I looked at the parks program was because it is publicly funded. And there's a real changing perception about community gardens. Like I said, they were started recreational activities, but now the conversation about community gardens is really about how they can bring about more equity. And so we're thinking about food security. Could these gardens be placed in areas where people need an opportunity to lower their grocery bills? Can it aid in self-determination and food sovereignty? And that was one thing that really came up a lot when I talked to people for this article.
And I recall during the pandemic when the city tried to close those community gardens, there was a bit of pushback saying, well, you know, we want our gardens. It's necessary for our health. We want access to our food. And I think there was some pushback because they didn't really want a lot of government interference. But I can see how the city would want to get these kind of in line and all on the same playing field, if you will.
Yes, there has been a lot of political activity around community gardens in the past year. So yes, when the first Honolulu lockdown started, people who, you know, really invested a lot of time and effort in their gardens were worried that they wouldn't be able to tend to their plants and their food. And then that particular part of the order was lifted, and so people who were in the community gardens were able to go back into their gardens. And then actually that's part of the reason this story came across my desk, because there is an unofficial community garden at Pu'uokapale, which is really focused on native plants. And when one of the people who tends that garden tried to show up when the lockdown order was lifted, she learned that that specific garden in Kapale didn't count because it wasn't one of the official community gardens. And so for her, it felt like another way that residents on the west side were being left out of opportunities.
And so what does the city say about possibly opening up more of these gardens on the west side?
Yeah, so I spoke very briefly with the director of the Parks and Recreation Department. You know, she's newly appointed, so she didn't have a set plan yet, but she did say she's supportive of opening more community gardens. She's a graduate of University of Hawaii's Master Gardener program, so she said she's supportive, and I'm hoping to see some sort of game plan for the future of the community garden program soon, and hopefully be able to highlight that on Civil Beat, whatever form it takes.
Yeah, and then you folks are, I guess, launching an emphasis to include more stories on the west side. So this is certainly an interesting one to look at, you know, if the community wants it, and see how the city responds and opens up and maybe make that one medicinal garden a part of that official garden, community garden system.
Yes, we definitely want to hear more from residents on the west side about what kind of coverage they want to see and the vision they see for their communities in the future.
All right. Thanks so much, Claire Caulfield.
Thank you for having me.
That was reporter Claire Caulfield with today's reality check. You can read her garden story at civilbeat.org. This month, we salute women in the driver's seat in a nod to Women's History Month. It was Nurse Clara Barton who founded the American Red Cross. Today, we take time to hear from Diane Peters Nguyen, the new CEO of the Red Cross of the Hawaii and Pacific region. A graduate of Kamehameha Schools, she looked to her Native Hawaiian roots from her grandmother's side for validation that the Hawaii Red Cross was the right place for her to be.
It is an amazing history, and I think, you know, Catherine, when I was initially thinking about the job, and it was after Coralie Matayoshi, of course, retired after like 17 years at the helm, and January of last year, you know, this whole long process started, and then it stopped because of the pandemic, and then it started up again. But along the way, I was, you know, I said, is this the right thing? Is this a good fit? And then the more I learned, I got connected to the stories and the mission. And so the legacy of strong women leadership in the Red Cross is one of the things that really attracted me. So the American Red Cross grew out of this international Red Cross movement in Europe, and Clara Barton, of course, founded it following her experiences on the battlefields, really, of the Civil War. And she was just such a pioneer and a, you know, rule breaker herself. She was an amazing woman. She started the American Red Cross when she was almost 60 years old.
Wow.
And just did so many things that people thought couldn't be done. And so, you know, out of her work, then there was a congressional charter in the turn of the century. But here in Hawaii, it was really through the work of Queen Liliʻuokalani in her final months that she, you know, helped launch the American Red Cross here in Hawaii in 1917 and launched, you know, the first membership drive, which was so incredibly successful that something like a third of the island's adult population became members of the Red Cross, including the Queen.
I know. That was just amazing for me to read. And then I also learned that what sewed the flag and that's flying at the Diamond Head office.
Yes, and so when I learned of this flag that she sewed personally and with her helpers, it flew over Iolani Palace during World War II. And so when I, the first day on the job, I asked to be shown this flag. They took me into where it was on the wall. It's encased, you know, it's in glass and everything. And although it did fly again for the centennial here in 2017, but I just, you know, felt her, the Queen's mana coming through. And I just felt like, okay, I'm in the right place at the right time.
It's important, though, to make those connects when you're trying to figure out, yeah, like you said, is this a good fit?
There were just so many stories along the way. So I've been, you know, speaking to different groups. I was last week speaking to a group of women leaders and this week to another women's group. But just, you know, sharing the things that I've learned and then the stories that have connected me along the way. And it's really amazing. And I feel so grateful to be part of this organization. It's really kind of amazing.
Because you took over and we had this pandemic, this health crisis, I know mm-hmm. there was lots of concern mm-hmm. because I think we had a hurricane barreling down and was like, how do we do
yes.
this, you know, distancing in a shelter? And do we just mm-hmm. encourage people to stay home if you can or go to someone else's home because you don't want 300 people at a shelter?
That's right. That's very true. And initially, of course, with the run-up to Hurricane Douglas when I had just started, there was all of that. We had shifted all the protocols to handle the things during the pandemic. And so, like you said, everything from social distancing to doing the health screening when people come in to doing the frequent cleansing. But having, you know, more room at the shelters meant either opening more shelters. In the end, they, of course, opened the Hawaii Convention Center, but still needing more volunteers. And the demographic of our volunteers tend to be, you know, a little bit older and in that age group where they are concerned about, you know, being out and in the midst of people and in closed spaces. So we really had to and still have to make huge effort to recruit, you know, a younger demographic and more diverse. And it also has given the whole Red Cross a need to focus on having the communities strengthen themselves. And what I mean by that is by looking to these communities, and especially in the rural areas, where, you know, something happens out in Hana, there's one road in and one road out. And that's true for many of our communities here on the islands, as well as, you know, we also cover Guam, which you're from, and yeah. American Samoa and NMI, Saipan. So, but strengthening the communities that we serve means recruiting volunteers from those communities and training them up, and not so much of, you know, flying in lots of people from the mainland, because we found that a lot of the things can be done remotely. And so this has been a shift for the whole Red Cross, even, you know, during this 2020 unprecedented right year in terms of natural disasters.
And while we're getting out of this situation with the pandemic and, you know, as more people get vaccinated, the need hasn't gone away because, you know, houses still burn down, storms keep coming.
Right. That's right. We say that, you know, emergencies don't stop in a pandemic, and neither does the Red Cross. And so we have here in Hawaii about every 4 to 7 days responding to some kind of emergency or disaster. So as you said, the most common, it would be the home fires, but certainly there's flooding events, you know, even with, you know, there's been a helicopter crash or a plane crash, or when a neighborhood or block is cordoned off for some kind of domestic shooting or, you know, whatever it may be, the Red Cross is responding.
I know that you offer also first aid classes, you know, certification
yes.
for folks that are trying to become lifeguards or EMTs. So have you been able to pivot with those types of classes and workshops?
Oh, great question. Yeah, the Red Cross offers lifeguard certification and classes for the, you know, beach side of things as well as pool lifeguards. We have swimming classes. Unfortunately, those are on hiatus, but we've continued through the pandemic with our, I just took mine actually, the CPR, AED, and first aid classes. So there's a portion that you do online, so it's kind of a hybrid, and it's quite extensive. And then you do some of it in person. So that is at our headquarters, which is kind of at the base of Diamond Head there. Still do that.
Right.
And that would just be redcross.org/take-a-class.
Okay, so some of those things are still being offered. And then I guess we'll just have to wait and see how this pandemic goes and the vaccinations, and then see what else you can resume.
Yes, and as far as the vaccination goes, we're actually now across Hawaii and the mainland as well. We have approval to help and assist at mass vaccination clinics. And so here we've been, for the last few weeks, I believe three or four events at Tripler Army Medical Center. Our Red Cross volunteers have been out, and I got to go in the last couple weeks. And, you know, it's just a thrill to put on the Red Cross vest and be part of that team. And we even had a group of young Red Cross nurse volunteers who were actually administering the vaccine. So, you know, I was only doing the traffic control part, but we're always recruiting volunteers to serve in, you know, numerous roles and help out in different ways.
Okay. And then I know you just got a big donation from a company.
Yes.
What was that? I'm trying to think.
Island Energy. Yeah, that was really exciting. And we just did a masked check presentation, and I think that was covered. And so, yeah, the need for donations still continues, you know, in fact increases, because the push towards having what we call non-congregate shelters, you know, putting people up in hotels or motels, obviously increases the expenses. But even with, you know, responding to home fires, we will provide for families financial assistance. So if they need to go and buy food, or they, you know, need to stay in a hotel, we will provide that assistance. And so, yes, we are always in a fundraising mode.
That was Diane Peters-Wynn, CEO of the Red Cross. And we should mention that March 24th is American Red Cross Giving Day. On the 20th of this month, more than a dozen volunteers from across the Pacific will be honored for their tireless contribution to this service organization. This past week, Honolulu Hale was lit up in red. Look to the Aloha Tower in the weeks to come, as it too will light up in red to mark Red Cross Month. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. On this week's Stargazer, HPR's Dave Lawrence and astronomer Christopher Phillips talk about scientists sharing their work through astronomy outreach.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe surrounding our tiny, troubled planet. And as usual, we're thrilled to have the expertise of astronomer Christopher Phillips to guide us. We've got him on the line. Hey, Chris, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, keep your eyes on the southwestern sky to glimpse the planet Mars. It will be visible till around 11:45 p.m. The moon this week is waning, and so it will appear as a mere thin crescent in our skies toward week's end.
And I understand you've got a little bit on the outreach that astronomers do.
Yeah, so many people wonder what astronomers do when they aren't hunched over their computer screens looking at data, writing code, or publishing papers. Well, if they're lucky, they get to do outreach.
And explain exactly what that is.
Well, outreach can take many forms. It could be visiting local schools, giving public tours of observatories, or in my case, appearing on local radio. Last week saw a gargantuan effort by scientists, staff, and educators on Hawaii Island known as Journey Through the Universe, a outreach festival.
And is this basically so folks can talk to astronomers and learn what's going on in astronomy?
Pretty much. If you've ever wanted to know about supernovae, what alien worlds may be like, or even something a little bit closer to home, such as why did the tides happen, then events like Journey Through the Universe give the public a chance to ask these questions in person.
And does every astronomer do outreach?
Well, most observatories around the world do some kind of outreach because they are, after all, public facilities funded by taxpayers. It gives the public a chance to ask questions and to get involved, but also it gives astronomers a chance to say, hey, look what I'm working on. Isn't it cool?
And back to that event on Hawaii Island, does that thing happen every year?
It does indeed. A Journey Through the Universe runs every year and has just wrapped up its 17th year.
Sounds like the science outreach portion is a pretty important part of astronomy.
Yes, but not just astronomy, but every science discipline. It gives people a chance to see where their money goes, but also it can inspire folks to get involved and perhaps even join the next generation of scientists, be they astronomers, physicists, or biologists.
Well, we're grateful to have your participation here with us. It's Christopher Phillips and another fun Stargazer. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week, and you can find Stargazer at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to create, maintain, and preserve open spaces for the Maui community. More at haleakalaranch.com.
In February, New Zealand became the latest country to make period products available for free in all public schools. They joined Scotland and six other U.S. states. A similar measure failed to pass in the Hawaii State Senate this legislative session. Nikki Ann Yee co-founded the Mu'i Movement in order to address period poverty in Hawaii. Her organization lobbied in favor of the bill, but that doesn't mean she's waiting for the government to come up with a solution. The Mu'i Movement pilots a new educational program this month that empowers students to take menstrual equity into their own hands. Nikki Ann Yee shared the details with the conversation's Savannah Harriman-Pope.
Period poverty is the inability to buy or access period products, such as pads or tampons, and that could be due to income constraints. It could also be if somebody is experiencing, whether it is cultural or societal shame and stigma. It can be not having a clean place with running water to hygienically take care of your menstruation. And it is also due to lack of proper menstrual hygiene and management education. Hawaii is a unique place in that it is, you know, beautiful, idyllic, a wonderful place to live. However, with that, there is a very high cost of living coupled with stagnant wages. And so local families face an economic situation where they're already constrained beyond, you know, normal levels or compared to other parts of the nation. Especially with the pandemic, we know that those families or individuals that are struggling to meet basic needs are certainly the ones that are also suffering in silence with period poverty. Our mission is to end period poverty in Hawaii. And my sisters and I, we believe it is our kuleana or responsibility that all individuals of menstruating age have the right to access products, that they have safe and hygienic places to use them, and also the right to manage their bodies. So in order to fulfill that, we do that by providing period products in monthly kits through organizations that we partner with. But we also acknowledge that not everybody will go to an organization if they need things. So we also allow people to direct requests through our website, and we mail to all islands. We are also advocating for systemic change. So this is at the government level and also within the community. And lastly, you know, we are really just trying to put out education. You know, although you would think that there's so much access, you know, with the internet and with social media, we're hearing from a lot of people that they just don't know what to do or they're confused. And there is a lot of misinformation out there. So we're also building up our education, not just about periods and anatomy, but also period management.
Hmm. And I understand that you had the first of an ongoing series of educational events this past Saturday. How did it go?
It went really well. We had program leads that, you know, had also joined. So that was really great because they are, you know, the main point of contact for our students and our young adults that are participating in it. One thing that we had to be very mindful of, and especially in this COVID area where students and young adults are still doing distance learning and not everybody has access to internet, you know, we created the program so that we could deliver the education in three ways. So one was the live session, which you just spoke about, that we're having on weekends, and it's only 30 to 45 minutes. I am presenting alongside a CUP educator. And then we are also offering it as a self-paced online module. And lastly is a printed form. So this is a booklet that we have, you know, prepared that is gender inclusive and locally inspired. So, you know, taking account into everybody's time constraints, their internet access, and even their comfort level, you know, this is how we have rolled out our series. Education was always a pillar of our organization because we knew that, you know, when it comes to period poverty, one of the factors contributing to that was a lack of education. And, you know, we've heard from organizations, from individuals, that they just don't know what to do sometimes. You know, people just assume that this is natural, you'll figure it out. But there is still a lot of misguidance out there. And so, you know, education got pushed to the forefront as part of this community project that I'm doing with Hawaii Children Action Network. And, you know, when you create a nonprofit with three sisters all dealing with their periods, we all manage very differently as well. And I'm that sister that, you know, just tries everything. But I also see that there are barriers when it comes to managing your period. So there are disposable products like pads, tampons, and panty liners that you'll see in any store you go to, whether it's Foodland or, you know, a small shop on the corner or the big ones like Target. But, you know, there are reusable period products out there, and that kind of carries its own sort of stigma too, that, you know, it's very limited to a specific type or group of people. But being one, you know, being a user myself, I said, okay, I can see the benefit, right? If, you know, people could just understand or they could try. And so that's where, you know, we really laid out the barriers. So there's a financial barrier, there's an education barrier, and there's an access barrier to reusable products. And so that's where we created this program so that we could give equitable access to period management, you know, beyond pads and tampons. And that's where we folded in and we partnered with companies that provide and make period underwear, menstrual cups, and cloth pads. And, you know, to address the education barrier, that's where the education series that, you know, I spoke about earlier really came to life. We have people that have received our kits calling us up, talking story, and I just love hearing from them because this really helps to shape the program. When people tell us what they're going through, then, you know, we are very quick to, you know, pivot our strategies or, you know, shifting our focuses or maybe even just broadening it. One example I can give, and this also was a main driver for our education series, was there was an organization that helped sex trafficking victims, and they asked us, do you have any material? They said it was because some of the girls that are coming through, they've never had a parent or a guardian or a trusted adult that, you know, could speak to them about their periods and menstruation and, you know, not just what's happening in their body, but how to take care of themselves. That deeply impacted me.
If you are not a student, but you want to get these resources into the hands of a student you may know, what's the best way to go about that?
People can go onto our website, maimovement.org/education. We have our booklet that is available. And so, you know, it's completely free. They can, you know, scroll through any of the videos. They can download the booklet themselves, print it out. You know, we do hope that the booklet is something that we can have available, you know, whether it's at organizations or at schools, but that's probably coming down a little bit later down the road.
I know that this is in conjunction with another initiative that you are running this month, a donation bot system. Can you talk a little bit about that?
This month, we are teaming up with Starbucks Women's Impact Network in Hawaii, and we have donation baskets and boxes from March 1st through March 14th in participating stores on Oahu and Hawaii Islands. You know, we're just completely blown away by the amount that, you know, people have been bringing into the stores and we're seeing on social media, people posting. So that's been, you know, really, really cool. And, you know, we also were approached by two Marino students who are tasked with doing a service project. And so they are very passionate about period poverty. And, you know, that's how they came across us on Instagram. And so their project, which is named Project GIRL, that stands for Girls Impacting Real Life, is aiming to raise donations. And part of the donations that are raised will go to organizations that they support. And part of the donations will come to us so that, you know, we can keep sending out our care kits across the island. And we are going to be having two drive-through donation drives with the Marino students. One will be in March and one will be in April. And, you know, to kind of close out Women's History Month, we are also going to be having donation baskets in Via Gelato and Keep It Simple Honolulu in Kaimuki.
That was Nikki Ann Yee of the Mu'i Movement, which she founded with her two sisters in order to address menstrual equity. You can find links to the educational program and their donation drives at our website. Well, we're all out of time. Tomorrow, we hear about the local landscape for electric vehicles as more automakers announce plans to get away from gas guzzlers. Are you thinking about buying an electric car? Call or talk backline 808-792-8217. Tweet us at HI Conversation or head to our Facebook page. And remember, all of our shows are archived. Find them on the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. We will be back tomorrow with more of the Conversation. Thank you.